am the Global Vice President for Impact Initiatives, which covers inclusive sustainable development, climate adaptation, humanitarian response, and many other aspects of helping us drive inclusive, sustainable, and what we call planetary stewardship at this organization called Planet, which I'm very excited to tell you about today. How many people here have heard of Planet Labs in one form or another? Okay, that's useful to know. I'll give you a few words of background for those of you who don't. Before I do, however, I want to just share a basic observation with you about the moment that we're in. Many of us are familiar with technology curves and technology growth curves that look something like this. We live in a world of accelerating capacity. The first machines, first computers, were less, you know, the ones that took human beings to the moon, less powerful than the ones on most of our wrists today. And now we have computers that are winning at chess, winning at Go, winning at Jeopardy. That's an incredibly important trend of accelerating capacity. But there's a companion curve that goes along with this, which is the decelerating curve of cost per unit of that capacity, which is intertwined with the first curve. So things are getting more powerful, and right behind them, they're getting a lot cheaper. That's the curve that puts a device in everybody's hand. It's the curve that drives very large-scale industrial systems as a consequence of needing to put new technologies in everybody's hands. It creates a management problem for many of us, which is that for a long time, as those curves are unfolding, they seem slow and overhyped. In America, we like to say, "Where's my jetpack?" I've been expecting my jetpack now for several generations, and no one's yet delivered it. But when those curves hit an important tipping point, all of a sudden, it seems sudden and urgent and really disruptive. We live in an era of very, very, very long fuses, but very big explosions, big, big moments of change. Just to give you one very quick example of that, I just want to show you two pictures just to give you a sense of the moment that we're in. Here is the election, the announcement of the voting of the cardinals to elect Pope Benedict Pope in 2005. Now, I'm going to show you these two images. There's one difference between them, and if you see it, I just like you, it's very careful, it's very subtle, it's hard to see. Here is the election of Pope Francis, same shot, in 2013. I want you to see if you can see a difference. There is a subtle difference there, but if you squint, you're likely to see it. Of course, the reason for this is that in 2007, we got the iPhone. And not just that, but the iPhone as a moment of continuity in a period of time in which these devices hit that takeoff moment. And when that happens, very powerful things can happen. Much of the success of the enterprise that I represent actually is a consequence of this moment. Because what Planet Labs is doing, we now call ourselves Planet, we dropped the labs, but I will refer to us both ways, is we produce very small satellites. We're actually producing the largest constellation of Earth-observing satellites in a sun-synchronous orbit, several hundred of them in an orbit between the sun and the Earth. And as the Earth turns, you know, the Earth is obviously on a tilt, but essentially from near pole to near pole, as the Earth spins perpendicular to the axis of those orbits, because each one is a camera powered by the same consumer technology that's in those phones, which is what enables them to be radically cheaper. We heard earlier, we have to make our satellites cheaper. These are orders of magnitude. They're not a little bit cheaper. They're orders of magnitude cheaper than comparable satellites of just a few years ago. Because we put them in this orbit, what that allows us to do, is to essentially put them in a ring around the Earth, and as the Earth turns, we scan the entire surface of the Earth every day in high resolution. So we see the entire terrestrial surface of the Earth at roughly 3 meters per pixel from very high latitudes. Now, we actually use two strategies for doing that. One is dedicated launches, which we launch from all over the world, where we piggyback on other launches that are going into sun-synchronous orbits. And then we also use the International Space Station as a test bed for these technologies. Just to give you a sense, in the last 2.5 years, we've done 14 iterations of this satellite. So just think about the normal time frame of concept to execution for a satellite. We've done 14 in just a couple of years and been able to test them on orbit as a consequence. That's enabled us to essentially lead with this mission, which is to image the whole Earth every day and to make that change universally accessible via the internet, via a cloud-based platform, and make it visible, accessible, and actionable. So it's a radically different proposition, and I hope you can tell at the very heart of that is a humanitarian and sort of planetary stewardship instinct. This is a company that is absolutely mission-led. We started with the mission, and then we thought, what was the commercial activity that would support, what are the set of commercial activities that would support that mission in perpetuity? Now, using this approach of leveraging very high-speed terrestrial innovation and rapidly shortening the time to getting those technologies on orbit has a huge additional benefit. One of those benefits is when this happens, as it did in November of 2014. What you're looking at is an explosion in Virginia when an Antares launch was about to go off course, so they detonated it essentially 1 second after takeoff. And what you can see there, some of those little bits of shrapnel are 26 Planet Lab satellites. 26 uninsured Planet Lab satellites are being destroyed before your very eyes in that shot. Now, that's not the end of the story, right? There was a moment when people went, now you can fill in the word for excrement. They had a moment like this, fill in the one in your own language. But this is the part that's really interesting. 2 months later, there was a SpaceX launch going to the same place. And the team spent 5 minutes going, holy smokes, we've just literally watched this big batch of satellites go up. And then it got to work. And in 11 days, designed, built, tested, manifested, and delivered for launch, a replacement batch, slightly smaller than that 26, but in 11 days and within roughly 60 days, had those satellites on orbit. So not only does cheaper mean and smaller and more effective mean that we can do missions that we could never do before, but we can fulfill them in ways we couldn't before, in ways that allow us to be incredibly agile. So that is it's a completely different way of thinking that marries Silicon Valley-style, very rapid, iterative development to humanitarian causes. Now, the thing I want to talk to you about is, what is the consequence of putting those devices in everybody's hands? Okay, so I don't know if any of you use your mobile phone to travel around. I don't know if you've ever seen anything that looks like this on your phone. Now, you'll notice that this happens to be a map of Los Angeles. In real time, it's the traffic in Los Angeles. This is from Google. Google has zero traffic sensors. What they're doing is they're monitoring the check-ins of all the Android phones. They're cross-referencing them with GPS, and they're finding out where all the ones that are only going about 0.5 kilometers an hour down the 405 freeway are, and they're registering that as a traffic jam. And they're incredibly precise. But the thing, and this is the world of big data that we're living in now, and the thing I want to tell you is nobody wants big data. We all celebrate big data, big data, big data. Big data is a giant pain in, again, fill in another part of your body. What people really want actually are the directions. They don't want the map. They want the indicator. That's a really important insight. It will be repeated throughout this presentation. Just to give you a sense of what that means, I want to share with you just one simple application. It uses something else from your mobile phone. It's a fantastic application. One of my favorites is called Street Bump. And what it does with mobile devices, it was built in the city of Boston, which has notoriously poor infrastructure and horrible drivers. Some of the worst reputation of drivers in the United States is in this city. And so we have bad roads and bad people, grumpy people. It's just a bad situation. So what the city of Boston did is they used the accelerometer in your phone, which detects vibration orientation. And I'll just come over here and grab it for a second. And as they gave this app to, required it of all their sanitation workers and firefighters and emergency responders. And as they're driving around doing their work as municipal workers, when they hit a bump, the phone registers the bump. and instantaneously fires off an alert to a centralized database that collects them. And once a certain threshold is met, a pothole repair crew is automatically dispatched to fill the pothole with no reporting and no requesting. So it's an automated feedback loop that uses the phones as a distributed sensor network. Now, the reason that's important is that's another kind of indicator, and it suggests the way that I want to share this with you, the way that we as commercial practitioners think with an eye toward how we're going to solve or at least address some of the critical participatory, global, ecological, social, and humanitarian challenges of this century. I took out the slide with the SDGs because everybody showed it, but how we're going to get at structural solutions at scale to some of those problems. So here's a little mental model that we use widely internally. At the bottom, we're all living through an information revolution. You can think about that. We've talked about the data revolution, the space renaissance, a sensor revolution. We are instrumenting society and the planet at scale. The amount of human accessible information has doubled within the last 12 months, according to IBM, and is now doubling faster than the annual rate. So we're undergoing an exponentiated growth in that volume of data, which could confuse us, and which could, I will say, disproportionately empower some people in society over others, I think per Edward's earlier astute comments, which we should come back to. So there's an important revolution that's happening there. On top of that information, there's another revolution, and that's an insights revolution. There's a combined machine learning and artificial intelligence analytics revolution, which is extracting information out of that information, and that's much quieter. Well, that's not getting as much attention, but it's just as powerful. If you can stably correlate insights across data sets over time, then what you can begin to build are not just big data, but big indicators. Indicators that are continuously updated using all of that information to give you much better information and guidance, essentially give you the driving directions, how to get from A to B, rather than the state of the system. And if those indicators are stable, we will begin to see the evolution of new instruments. And by that, I don't mean technical instruments. I mean financial instruments, societal instruments, policy instruments. Now, the thing to understand about that stack is when you go from information to instrument, down here, there's a lot more information and a lot less value. Up there, there's a lot more value and a lot less information. By definition, you want the contextual directions to guide behavior, whether it's guiding the behavior of markets or societies. The important thing to say is where we are right now is right here. This journey is 10% done. We're at the beginning of a very big change in how we measure. The challenge is we've got a race to get there, especially if we're going to make material and informed progress on, say, the 2030 agenda within the time frame that we have to within the 2030 agenda, not, you know, after the window has passed. So I want to give you a couple of examples, and I'm only going to give you a couple in the interest of time, that show you how these things work. Some of them will come from Planet, but many of them will not, just to kind of give you a broad sense. Okay, this is some work we're actually doing with one of Edward's colleagues in the Philippines. What we're doing here is addressing that fundamental information gap need, which we heard about, which is, if you don't know where the infrastructure is, if you don't know where the roads are, there's all kinds of things you can't do. It's essential for the delivery of critical systems. That's why we build roads in the first place. So on the island of Mindanao, we've actually taken a subset of Mindanao, and you can see this road tracing work. That road tracing tells you the geometry of the roads. It also tells you what types of roads they are. So how do we do that? Well, satellite imagery is providing the base layer image there, the cloudless composite image of what's going on. There's still a few clouds, but it was very rapidly produced, and that's one of the benefits of imaging the whole Earth every day. The Earth is incredibly cloudy. When you have very rapid, high-cadence imaging, you're much more likely to get a cloudless composite, say, in a week, than you would if you're just going by and compositing from, you know, once or twice a year. Now, what we do with that is we take that base layer, we break it up into pieces of information. We do something very unexpected with it, which is that we feed it to video gamers, little segments of the image are fed to video gamers, and they're offered something of extraordinary value, 100 gold pieces in World of Warcraft or some equivalent video game, if they can trace where the roads are using within 2 or 3% of accuracy based on a sample set that we've previously randomly assigned. So we give them one that we've done, we give them one that's never been done, and we get them to do it with fairly high degrees of accuracy and concurrent within the range of error of other people who've done the same task. If they do it well, we give them some gold pieces, and then we feed those raw tracings to people on the street. We actually give people through a partner organization on mopeds using a special piece of software called RouteChute, and they actually drive those routes. They record the nature of the infrastructure, and then all of that information is fed into a learning algorithm that extrapolates over the larger set and feeds the result into the kind of open repository for roads that we were just talking about through Humanitarian OpenStreetMap. That's the long-term trajectory of this. So this is using human beings and computers in conjunction with each other to do things much faster and much cheaper than they could. And the important thing here is it's not geospatial data that's the silver bullet. It's one element of a constellation of tools that get used together to do things faster, cheaper, and ultimately in a more participatory way. The thing that's really powerful about this whole approach, this whole thing I just showed you, is this. And this is the most important thing. When you've built an algorithm that can do this kind of work, every observation you make makes the algorithm better, or at worst is neutral. So if you have high confidence in the data, what you're doing is you're training the algorithm to get better and better, eventually better than human beings can do it, which really drops the price. But even more important than that is you're building a learning planet. You're building an ecosystem that essentially teaches itself, where we're teaching our machines and our machines are teaching us. Now, that kind of analysis, elements of that analysis are now being used. A couple of weeks ago, for instance, some partners of ours we work very closely with now at Stanford have been using ground-based data, terrestrial survey data that they get from the bank and from other sources, and geospatial imagery to do extremely accurate maps of poverty using geospatial imagery. This is now in the last issue of Science. Again, that's all in the middle layers. That's in the insight and the indicator, right? Here we're building poverty indicators where in some cases it's far too challenging to do the collection work at scale. When you've got that kind of information in hand, you can start to build new instruments. And in fact, we're just working with a commercial enterprise right now. This is a making money private sector company, not a humanitarian, it's also a humanitarian company, but its purpose is to make money, called FarmDrive. And what they're doing, these are large plantations in Kenya. Over here you have some smallholder agriculture. What we're doing is using some of the very same techniques to quantify smallholder agricultural productivity in a way that allows FarmDrive to work with local financing institutions to enable farmers to better monetize and provide better financial services to smallholders as a commercial proposition. Because as the cost of the data and the cost of the analytics comes down, suddenly it becomes profitable to service communities who've previously been excluded. And that is the definition of disruptive innovation. Now, there's one or two other ones I'll just tell you really quickly. A couple of weeks ago, we had an earthquake here in Italy. This just popped up in one of our Twitter feeds, essentially the day of the earthquake, sort of later in the day of the earthquake. When you are collecting the whole Earth every day, you are able to produce extremely high cadence disaster imagery. So for instance, this was delivered to everybody on the 24th. On the 25th, we were able to show, now these are uncorrected images, so I apologize, they're a little zoomed in, but we were able to do automated analysis that showed essentially where the damaged buildings were, where tarps had been set up, and begin to do some crowdsource-based feature extraction, which we delivered to those communities on the ground to accelerate disaster response. But just as importantly, we also had the most recent imagery of the area before the disaster, because a permanent monitoring function for the planet does not discriminate. It doesn't discriminate between Amatrice, Tanzania, it doesn't Palo Alto or Beijing. It's essentially the Earth is the Earth. As a consequence, we're seeing all kinds of things. This is just 2 weeks of growth, say, in a refugee camp in Jordan. Here's February 9th. Here's February 26th. I'll just go back and forth. Because it may be a little bit difficult to see, I'll just show you the first level machine learning layer that's just looking for high contrast changes in this environment. So you can see, if you just look, I can't quite do it, but if you just look right sort of where my finger is pointing, there's three little dots in a row, in a kind of vertical row. And you can just watch new tents appear in a matter of weeks. So we've done, right now we're doing research that allows us to quantify the, There's no thermal. This is just optical and near infrared. But here, in this instance, we've actually got a research project with an academic partner who's doing population estimates, automated population estimates and feature extraction at relatively low level. Do I have a moment, or are we over? Just a moment. We're late. Okay. Could I indulge you for one more minute, and then I'm going to stop? Okay. I just want to tell you, in Peru, here are the kinds of things, and just to give you a sense of what's coming. In Peru, there's a very large protected area. The Peruvian Amazon is nine times the size of Texas. It's impossible for human beings to monitor it all in real time. And it's very expensive to point cameras at the ground to understand what it's doing, what's happening there. Planet does not have that problem, and as a consequence, this is literally, you're looking into the, like an early version of our online tool. So this is the tool we use every day. This is in the border of the protected area in an area called Madre de Dios. These images are a couple of months apart, and you can actually see deforestation happening in front of your eyes. We actually are able to see it now sometimes on a week-to-week basis, and when you're able to do that, you can shift from doing what happened kinds of analysis to what is going to happen, to shift toward predictive analytics as opposed to retroactive analytics. Terrible things happening on the ground where this deforestation, this is all for gold mining in Peru, but this information actually made it onto the front page of the newspaper in Peru through an organization that does the analysis based on this data, and then within a matter of days, the Peruvian Coast Guard came in and shut down all of the operations, destroyed all the equipment, and stopped the deforestation. Now, the reason that's important, and this is the last idea I want to leave you with, if you have an instrument that allows you, if you have an information layer that allows you to see in real time what's happening in our forests, and you have a mechanism for detecting change, and you have a mechanism for interdiction of change, interruption of change that you don't like, then you may be on the way toward being in a position to financially secure that carbon in a way that meets the criteria of the world's financial markets. And that is exactly the conversations that we're having right now. So I really believe at the end of the day, the reason that private sector enterprises are in this is not only because they want to save money, but because the customers they're going to enable are going to help save the planet, and they're going to make bundles of cash doing it. Once we yoke conservation to the bond markets, you know, very interesting things will happen. And with that, I will say thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here with all of you.